The Songs of the Cell. I do not know which to prefer, the beauty of inflections, or the beauty of innuendos, the blackbird whistling, or just after. Wallace Stevens, 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird. In his 2021 book on ecology and climate, The Nutmeg's Curse, Parables for a Planet in Crisis, Amitav Ghosh recounts the story of an eminent professor of botany who accompanies a young man from a local village to guide him through a rainforest. The young man is able to identify each of the various plant species. His acumen stuns the professor, who compliments him on his knowledge. But the man is dejected. He nods and replies with downcast eyes, "Yes, I've learned the names of all the bushes, but I've yet to learn the songs." Many readers might read the word song as metaphorical, but in my reading, it's far from a metaphor. What the young man laments is that he hasn't learned the interconnectedness of the individual inhabitants of the rainforest, their ecology, interdependence, how the forest acts and lives as a whole. A song can be both an internal message, a hum, and equally an external one, a message sent out from one being to another to signal interconnectedness and cooperativity. Songs are often sung together or to one another. We can name cells, and even systems of cells, but we are yet to learn the songs of cell biology. This, then, is the challenge. We've divided the body into organs and systems. Organs that perform discrete functions, kidneys, hearts, livers, and systems of cells, immune cells, neurons, that enable these functions. We've identified the signals that move between them, some at short range and some at long range. That's already a radical advance from Hooke and Leeuwenhoek, who first envisioned the body as agglomerations of unitary, independent living blocks. It brings us closer to Virchow, who imagined the body as a citizenship. But there are still gaps in our understanding of the interconnectedness of cells. We are still living in a world where we imagine the cell, as Leeuwenhoek did, as a living atom, unitary, singular, and isolated, a spaceship floating in body space. Until we leave that atomistic world, we will not know, as the English surgeon Stephen Paget asked, why the liver and spleen are the same size, are anatomical neighbors, possess virtually the same flux of blood, and yet one, the liver, is among the most frequent sites of cancer metastases, while the other, the spleen, rarely has any. Or why patients with certain neurodegenerative diseases, Parkinson's among them, have a markedly lower risk of cancer. Or why, as Helen Mayberg told me, the patients who describe their depression as an existential ennui, her words, typically do not respond to deep brain stimulation, while those that describe themselves as falling into vertical holes often do. Like the dejected man in the rainforest, we have learned the names of the bushes, but not the songs that move between the trees. Years ago, a friend told me a story that still resonates. He was walking with his grandfather, visiting from Cape Town, South Africa, when the grandfather stopped at a random apartment building in Newton, Massachusetts, where many first and second generation immigrant Jews had settled. My friend's great-grandfather had emigrated to South Africa from Lithuania. The grandfather walked up to the building and wanted to look at the names printed by the doorbells of the apartments. "But Grandpa," my friend protested, "we don't know anyone who lives in the building." The grandfather paused and smiled. "Oh, no," he said. "We know everyone who lives in this building." To build new humans out of cells, we need knowledge that is not just names, but the interconnectedness between names. Not addresses, but neighborhoods. Not identification cards, but personalities, stories, and the histories that accompany them. Perhaps, as we near the end of this audiobook, we might pause to reflect on one of the most potent philosophical legacies of 20th century science, and its limitations. Atomism argues that material, informational, and biological objects are built out of unitary substances. Atoms, bytes, genes, I had written in an earlier book. To this we might add, cells. We are built of unitary blocks, extraordinarily diverse in shape, size, and function, but unitary nonetheless. Why? The answers can only be speculative. Because in biology, it is easier to evolve complex organisms out of unitary blocks by permuting and combining them into different organ systems, enabling each to have a specialized function while retaining features that are common across all cells: metabolism, waste disposal, protein synthesis. A heart cell, a neuron, a pancreatic cell, and a kidney cell rely on these commonalities: mitochondria to generate energy, a lipid membrane to define its boundaries, ribosomes to synthesize its proteins, the ER and Golgi to export proteins, membrane-spanning pores to let signals in and out, a nucleus to house its genome. And yet, despite the commonalities, they are functionally diverse. A heart cell uses mitochondrial energy to contract and act as a pump. A beta cell in the pancreas uses that energy to synthesize and export the hormone insulin. A kidney cell uses membrane-spanning channels to regulate salt. A neuron uses a different set of membrane channels to send signals that enable sensation, sentience, and consciousness. Think of the number of different architectures you can build with 1,000 differently shaped Lego blocks. Or perhaps we might reframe the answer in evolutionary terms. Recall that unicellular organisms evolved into multicellular organisms, not once, but many independent times. The driving forces that goaded that evolution, we think, were the capacity to escape predation, the ability to compete more effectively for scarce resources, and to conserve energy by specialization and diversification. Unitary blocks, cells, found mechanisms to achieve this specialization and diversification by combining common programs: metabolism, protein synthesis, waste disposal, with specialized programs: contractility in the case of muscle cells, or insulin-secreting capacity in pancreatic beta cells. Cells coalesced, repurposed, diversified, and conquered. But powerful as it might be, atomism, we've learned, is reaching its explanatory limits. We can explain much about the physical, chemical, and biological worlds through evolutionary agglomerations of atomistic units, but those explanations are straining at their leashes. Genes by themselves are strikingly incomplete explanations of the complexities and diversities of organisms. We need to add gene-gene interactions and gene-environment interactions to explain organismal physiology and fates. Decades ahead of her time, the geneticist Barbara McClintock called the genome a sensitive organ of the cell. The words organ and sensitive reflected ideas totally foreign to geneticists in the 50s and 60s. Arguing against the atomistic gene-by-gene approach favored by geneticists, McClintock proposed the genome could only be interpreted as a whole, as a sensitive organ that was responsive to its environment. By that same logic, cells, by themselves, are incomplete explanations for organismal complexities. We need to factor in cell-cell interactions and cell-environment interactions, ushering in holism in cell biology. We possess rudimentary terms for these interactions: ecologies, sociologies, interactomies, but still lack models, equations, and mechanisms to understand them. I return often to think of disease as a violation of the social compacts between cells. Part of the problem is that the word holism has become scientifically defiled. It has become synonymous with the mushing of everything we understand into a malfunctioning, soft-bladed and soft-headed blender. To rephrase Orwell, one equation, good; four equations, bad. And then things got worse. A variant of postmodern scientific thought threw the equations, with the blackboards they were written on, into the trash. The baby went with the bathwater. But that, too, is an equal and opposite nonsense. A Newtonian ball thrown into Newtonian space does follow Newtonian laws. The laws that govern the ball are as real and tangible as they were during the conception of the universe. By the same logic, a cell and a gene are real. It's just that they aren't real in isolation. They are fundamentally cooperative, integrating units, and together they build, maintain, and repair organisms. I cannot help you hold both ideas in your head at the same moment. But perhaps some experience with non-Western philosophies might help here. Cooperative and unitary, selfless and self-regarding, are not mutually exclusive ideas. They exist in parallel. Universal principles satisfy us, one equation good, because they satisfy our belief in an ordered universe. But why must order be so soldierly, so singular, so unifest as opposed to manifest? Perhaps one manifesto for the future of cell biology is to integrate atomism and holism. Multicellularity evolved again and again because cells, while retaining their boundaries, found multiple benefits in citizenship. Perhaps we, too, should begin to move from the one to the many. That, more than any other, is the advantage of understanding cellular systems and, beyond that, cellular ecosystems. We need to know everyone who lives in this building. In January 1902, just as the danse macabre of German sectarian division, based on the pseudoscience of racial and biological anthropology, was beginning to whir around him, Rudolf Virchow, running from appointment to appointment, missed his footing while stepping off an electric streetcar at Leipziger Street in Berlin. He fell off, injuring his thigh. He had fractured his femoral bone. By then he had become weak and debilitated. A little, yellow-skinned, owl-faced, spectacled man, as an assistant wrote, with peculiarly piercing yet slightly veiled eyes which were conspicuously lacking in eyelashes. The eyelids were parchment-like and thin as paper. He was eating a roll in butter as we entered, and beside his plate stood a cup of café au lait. This was his lunch, his only refreshment between breakfast and dinner. A cascade of cellular pathology was unleashed. The fractured hip was likely the consequence of brittle bone, and the fragility of bone the consequence of aging bone cells unable to maintain or repair the structural integrity of the femur. He spent the summer recovering, but then there were further setbacks. An infection from a weakened immune system, another cellular alteration, that then cascaded into heart failure, a malfunction of cardiac cells. System by system, the societies of cells that had held a man in place fell apart. He died on September 5, 1902. Virchow continued to work on his understanding of cellular physiology and its converse, cellular pathology, right until his moment of death. The many seminal ideas sparked by his work, and their many offshoots over the ensuing decades, are his lasting legacy and the lessons of this audiobook. His founding tenets of cell biology have expanded into at least 10 that I can enumerate, but there will be more as we deepen our understanding of cells. 1. All cells come from cells. 2. The first human cell gives rise to all human tissues. Ipso facto, every cell in the human body can be produced, in principle, from an embryonic cell, or stem cell. 3. Although cells vary widely in their form and function, there are deep physiological similarities that run through them. 4. These physiological similarities can be repurposed by cells for specialized functions. An immune cell uses its molecular apparatus for ingestion to eat microbes. A glial cell uses similar pathways to prune synapses in the brain. 5. Systems of cells with specialized functions, communicating with each other through short and long-range messages, can achieve powerful physiological functions that individual cells cannot achieve. For example, the healing of wounds, the signaling of metabolic states, sentience, cognition, homeostasis, immunity. The human body functions as a citizenship of cooperating cells. The disintegration of this citizenship tips us from wellness into disease. 6. Cellular physiology is thus the basis for human physiology, and cellular pathology is the basis for human pathology. 7. The processes of decay, repair, and rejuvenation in individual organs are idiosyncratic. Specialized cells in some organs are responsible for consistent repair and rejuvenation. Blood rejuvenates through human adulthood, albeit at diminished rates, but other organs lack such cells. Nerve cells rarely rejuvenate. The balance between injury/decay and repair/rejuvenation ultimately results in the integrity or degeneration of an organ. 8. Beyond understanding cells in isolation, deciphering the internal laws of cellular citizenship, tolerance, communication, specialization, diversity, boundary formation, cooperation, niches, ecological relationships, will ultimately result in the birth of a new kind of cellular medicine. 9. The capacity to build new humans out of our building blocks, that is, cells, lies very much within the reach of medicine today. Cellular re-engineering can ameliorate or even reverse cellular pathology. 10. Cellular engineering has already allowed us to rebuild parts of humans with re-engineered cells. As our understanding of this arena grows, new medical and ethical conundrums will arise, intensifying and challenging the basic definition of who we are and how much we wish to change ourselves. These tenets continue to animate, drive, and even surprise us today. As doctors, we learn these principles. As patients, we live them. As humans, entering a new realm of medicine, we will have to learn how to embrace them, challenge them, and incorporate them into our cultures, societies, and selves. Epilogue. Better versions of me. If we could be less human, if we could stand out of the range of the cataracts of the given and not find our pockets swollen with change we haven't, but must have, stolen, who wouldn't? K. Ryan, The Test We Set Ourselves, 2010. But I too made things that may one day be better versions of me. Walter Schrank, Battle Cries of Every Size, 2021. A few weeks before Paul Greengard died, we took another walk on the slippery marble stones at Rockefeller University. We walked past the building where George Palladay had started his basement lab and dissected parts and subparts of the cell using biochemistry and electron microscopy. Part of the campus was cordoned off and scaffolded. Workers were building a new lab. I was interested in talking to Greengard about making new humans. "You mean genetically?" he asked. He was referring to new technologies, gene editing among them, that had allowed researchers such as He Zhanque to attempt deliberate alterations in the human genome. But I didn't mean genetically, or at least not just genetically. Think of Emily Whitehead, whose immune system was rebuilt with T-cells weaponized to kill her cancer. Louise Brown, the first baby born through IVF. Or Timothy Ray Brown, the patient with AIDS who had received a bone marrow transplant from a donor with cells resistant to HIV. He, too, had been rebuilt with new cells. Nancy Lowry, living with her sister's blood, Helen Mayberg's first patients, implanted with tiny electrical stimulators with electrodes and bolts of energy running through the neurons in their brains. Why not extend the building of human parts to other cellular systems? Rebuild the failing pancreas in a type 1 diabetic with insulin-producing cells, or replace an arthritic woman's grinding joints with new cartilage. I told him about Verve and how it was trying to create humans with liver cells that would permanently lower cholesterol. Greengard nodded. He had just listened to a seminar on neural organoids, tiny clusters of neuronal cells that, cultured in a matrix-like solution in the lab, organized themselves into ball-like shapes. Researchers had started calling them mini-brains. An exaggeration, no doubt, but there was something undeniably creepy about watching tiny balls with human neurons firing and communicating with each other. Had a thought, no matter how garbled, ever fired within one such organelle? If we poked them, did they feel sensation? One morning, Togrul Jafarov, the postdoc in my lab, showed me a culture full of gremlin-expressing cells he had harvested from a mouse. They glowed green because that fluorescent jellyfish protein, GFP, had been inserted into their genomes. At first, nothing happened. The cells sat obdurately in the flask. But then they began to divide, slowly at first and then furiously. They formed tiny worlds of cartilage around themselves. When the flask was full of millions of cells, Jafarov drew them up into a tiny needle, about as thick as two strands of human hair, and injected them into the knee joints of mice. He'd been working on the procedure for months and perfected it slowly. He had to enter the joint with the needle causing no injury, like a perfect diver slicing into water without causing a splash. A few weeks later, he showed me the knee. The cells had formed a thin layer of cartilage at the joint. We had made a chimeric knee with a jellyfish protein in its cells, glowing silently within the mouse. It was far from perfect. Just a few cells had engrafted, but it was clearly the first step to build a new cellular joint. In the strangest of Kazuo Ishiguro's novels, Never Let Me Go, we are cast into the future when human cloning has become legalized. We meet a group of schoolchildren. They live in a boarding school named Hailsham, perhaps a veiled reference to the sham school that houses them. Slowly, the students discover that their sole purpose is to act as donors for the adults that they've been cloned from. Bit by bit, organs are removed from them and donated to their older clones. Once the organs have been harvested, the children will inevitably die. At one point in the novel, one of the children, Kathy, encounters some drawings made by Tom, a friend and eventual lover. "I was taken aback," she says, "at how densely detailed each one was. In fact, it took a moment to see they were animals at all. The first impression was like one you'd get if you took the back off a radio set. Tiny canals, weaving tendons, miniature screws and wheels were all drawn with obsessive precision, and only when you held the page away could you see it was some kind of armadillo, say, or a bird. For all their busy metallic features, there was something sweet, even vulnerable, about each of them. The tiny canals, weaving tendons, miniature screws and wheels are, perhaps, metaphors for anatomy, organs and cells, redrawn as movable fixtures that can be pulled out, reassembled, and transferred, like blocks, from one human to another. As the critic Louis Menand wrote in The New Yorker, "The shadowy backdrop in Never Let Me Go is genetic engineering and associated technologies." But that's not quite right. The backdrop is cellular engineering. I read Ishiguro's novel why Jafarov harvested the cartilage cells from one mouse and transferred them into another. The first mouse had to be sacrificed. The experiment was not in vain. He was searching for a cure for human arthritis, a crippling, debilitating illness that leaves hundreds of thousands unable to move. But I cannot write this and think of the experiment without feeling a pang of remorse and the inescapable shiver of concern of what such a future might bring. We've met new humans throughout this audiobook, and we've encountered ideas about making newer humans, part by part, using cells. Some of these ideas lie in the far future, perhaps, but some of it is happening as I write. As I described earlier, a group of researchers, including Jeff Karp and Doug Malton, are making an artificial pancreas, hoping to implant this neo-organ into type 1 diabetics. Two companies, Vertex and Viacyte, are already enrolling patients to infuse them with pancreatic insulin-producing cells created by making stem cells turn into pancreatic cells. At the Mayo Clinic, scientists are making a bio-artificial liver, building it out of liver cells. Hearts used to be harvested from cadavers, but one ambitious cell engineering project involves mounting cardiac muscle cells, derived from stem cells on a collagenous scaffold that resembles the heart, to build a bio-artificial heart out of cells. Ishiguro's novel is described as science fiction, and fictional it is. I cannot imagine us cloning and sacrificing humans to act as organ donors. But what about cellular engineering as a means to human enhancement? One experiment that Togrul Jafarov is trying to perform in the lab is to inject the bone cartilage stem cells into the limbs and joints of very young mice. Would they become taller, with jackrabbit limbs, except in mouse bodies? Mice rabbits? Again, this is not an experiment performed in vain. There are humans with extreme short stature, some of whom want to be taller, but not all. Some with short stature argue that their lives are perfectly fine. Some are healthy and happy. Ascribing a disability to them, they argue, is to assign some unique ability. Can height be construed as an ability? To the rest of us. But what if a normal human wanted to enhance his or her height through cellular therapy? That seems to be not science fictional. It could lie within our imagination of a shadowy future. Would we stop them? And if so, why? The philosopher Michael Sandel has been pondering this question for a while. Years ago, I met him briefly in Aspen, Colorado, following a seminar he presented on genetic engineering and human cloning as a quest for perfection. It was a beautiful afternoon among the hills and quivering aspen leaves. In his blue jacket and tie, Sandel looked manicured and professorial. Then again, he is a professor in Harvard's philosophy department. The talk was a provocation. Sandel challenged the human quest for enhancement, basing his argument ultimately on what the late theologian William May called an openness to the unbidded. The unbidded, the vagaries or gifts of chance, Sandel argues, is essential to human nature. Our children surprise us with their gifts, and those surprises and our responses to them would be extinguished if each one of us launched a quest for enhancement, for perfection. It would violate an essential part of the human spirit to do away with the unbidden gifts, better wrestle with these vagaries and make the best of them. In 2004, Sandel consolidated his ideas in an essay, The Case Against Perfection, which he soon expanded into a book. Reviewing the book in The Times, the ethicist William Salatin wrote, "Sandel's deeper worry is that some kinds of enhancement violate the norms embedded in human practices. Baseball, for example, is supposed to develop and celebrate an array of talents. Steroids warp the game. Parents are supposed to cultivate children through unconditional as well as conditional love. Selecting a baby's sex betrays that relationship." To argue against human enhancement, Salatin continues, "Sandel needs something deeper, a common foundation for the various norms in sports, arts, and parenting. He thinks he has found it in the idea of giftedness. To some degree, being a good parent, athlete, or performer is about accepting and cherishing the raw material you've been given to work with. Strengthen your body, but respect it. Challenge your child, but love her. Celebrate nature, don't try to control everything. Why should we accept our lot as a gift? Because the loss of such reverence would change our moral landscape." I used to find Sandel's argument persuasive, but as the combined forces of genetics and cell engineering extend their reach to touch new depths of the human body and personhood, the moral landscape has changed radically. The borderlands between the emancipation from the ravages of disease, extreme short stature, or muscle-wasting cachexia, and the augmentation of human features, increasing height or bulking up muscle, are blurring. Augmentation has become the new emancipation, and the more the borderlands between ailment and enhancement blur, the more easily the raw material that Salatin describes is perceived as precisely that, raw, and therefore awaiting to be molded into something else, a new kind of human built anew. Cooked, the opposite of raw, carries a connotation of augmentation, but also of cheating. But is enhancement cheating? What if it was used to prevent a disease for an illness that may or may not occur? Should an aging knee be injected with cartilage-forming stem cells before it succumbs to osteoarthritis? That is, in a state of pre-disease? In Silicon Valley, not far from Stanford's hospital where children with leukemia await transplants to generate new blood, a startup called Ambrosia is offering transfusions of matched young blood plasma, quote, harvested from youths between 16 and 25 years old, to supposedly rejuvenate the creaking but very wealthy, shriveling bodies of aging billionaires. Rather than draining old blood from the dead, you infuse young blood into the aged. Embalmment in reverse. I am tempted to draw an analogy to vampirism, but perhaps we will find a new euphemism for this chilling kind of attempted cellular rejuvenation, rebalming, or de-mummification. 1 liter of young blood costs $8,000. 2 liters is a bargain at $12,000. In 2019, the FDA issued a stern cautionary note against the program, citing lack of benefit, although Ambrosia argues that the therapy works. Accepting and cherishing the raw material you've been given to work with. What raw material? Sandel's and Salatin's discussion focuses on genes. And indeed, gene therapy, gene editing, and genetic selection has preoccupied ethicists, doctors, and philosophers for the last decade. But genes are lifeless without cells. The real raw material of the human body is not information, but the way that information is enlivened, decoded, transformed, and integrated. That is, by cells. The genomic revolution has induced a kind of moral vertigo, Sandel writes, but it is the cellular revolution that will actualize this moral vertigo. William Kay was a young man with an ancient illness. I saw him when I was a fellow in hematology in Boston, first in the wards and then in my clinic. He was 21 and had sickle cell anemia. He was admitted to the hospital about once a month with a crisis, a syndrome involving pain in his bones and chest so unfathomably intense that only a continuous intravenous morphine drip could quench it. Sickle cell anemia is a disease that we understand at a cellular and molecular level. It is a disease of hemoglobin, the oxygen-carrying molecule found within red blood cells, which may be one of the most sophisticated molecular machines devised by evolution. Hemoglobin is a complex of four proteins, and it's shaped like a four-leafed clover. Two of the leaves are formed by a protein named alpha-globin, while two are another protein named beta-globin. Nestled at the center of each of the proteins is another chemical, heme. And at the center of heme sits an atom of iron. It is a doll within a doll within a doll scheme. Red blood cells contain hemoglobin molecules that contain heme that in turn clasps iron atoms. It's the iron that binds and unbinds the oxygen. The elaborate apparatus built around those four iron atoms in the hemoglobin molecule has a distinct molecular purpose. Red blood cells cannot simply bind oxygen and hold on to it. They have to release it. The red cells pick their payload, oxygen, from the capillaries of the lung and ferry it around. And when the cells reach oxygen-poor environments in the body, with the heart muscle pumping and pushing them around minute after minute, hemoglobin literally twists and unclasps the oxygen that the iron atoms have bound. Hemoglobin is blood's hidden secret, a complex of proteins so vital to our existence as organisms that we have evolved a cell whose principal job is to act as a suitcase to carry it around. But this system of oxygen delivery fails if hemoglobin, the oxygen carrier, is malformed. In sickle cell anemia, you inherit a mutation in both copies of the beta-globin gene. The mutation is exquisitely subtle. It results in the change of one amino acid in beta-globin, but the effects are devastating. That single change creates a protein that, no longer a glob, clumps into fiber-like clusters in oxygen-poor environments. The fibrous clumps deform the shape of the red blood cell. Rather than a coin-shaped cell that floats easily through blood, the clumps of hemoglobin tug at the cell's membrane. The cell shrivels into a quarter-moon crescent, a sickle that cannot float easily in the blood. It aggregates and clogs the blood vessels, especially in tissues that have low oxygen content. The deep insides of the marrow, in the distal tips of the fingers and toes, or in the depths of the intestines. The pain that this clogging of capillaries produces is like a corkscrew driven into the bones. William described each episode like being forced to enter a torture chamber, and then all the doors around you get locked. It's like a heart attack of the marrow or of the intestines. The medical term for the syndrome is a sickle cell crisis. William Kay had one such episode every month. He would be admitted to the hospital writhing in agony. When the pain partially subsided, he would be discharged home with oral pain medicines. But the twin demons of the possibility of addiction to opioids and the anticipation of the next crisis hung over him, as much as they hung over me. As a fellow assigned to his care, my job was to harness these demons, giving him just enough medicine to control his pain, but not overshooting the mark. Between 2019 and 2021, multiple independent groups reported trials of gene therapy strategies to treat sickle cell anemia. One strategy involves harvesting a patient's blood stem cells, as with a standard transplant. A virus is then used to deliver a corrected copy of the beta-globin gene into the stem cells. These patient blood stem cells, now bearing a corrected copy of the gene, are transplanted back into the patient, and the blood that grows out of the stem cells now permanently bears the corrected gene. Although several patients were treated and demonstrated benefits, the trial was halted because two patients developed a leukemia-like disease. Whether the leukemia was the consequence of the virus or of the chemotherapy required for the transplant remains unknown. Another strategy, ingenious in its take, exploits a twist in human physiology. Fetal blood cells, unlike adult red blood cells, express a different form of hemoglobin. Submerged in womb fluid, where oxygen levels are extremely low, the fetus needs to extract oxygen aggressively from its mother's blood cells that come through the umbilical cord. In later life, once its own lungs become functional, the fetus's cells switch over to adult hemoglobin. Fetal blood cells therefore carry a unique form of hemoglobin, fetal hemoglobin, that is especially designed to extricate oxygen in the fetal environment. Like adult hemoglobin, fetal hemoglobin also has four chains, two alpha and two gamma globin chains. But since none of its chains is encoded by beta hemoglobin, the gene mutated in sickle cell patients, there is no mutation to cause sickling. It is perfectly normal, doesn't have the property of distorting the blood cell, and in fact can function especially well in low oxygen environments. Stuart Orkin and David Williams, working with a team of researchers and a cellular therapy company, have found a way to permanently activate fetal hemoglobin in blood stem cells, thereby overriding the sickled form of adult hemoglobin. Blood stem cells are extracted from sickle cell patients, manipulated by gene editing to re-express fetal hemoglobin in an adult, and then transplanted back into the patient. In essence, adult red blood cells turn into fetal cells and are no longer susceptible to sickling. Old blood becomes young. In a trial reported in 2021, a 33-year-old woman with sickle cell anemia was treated with this strategy. The level of hemoglobin in her blood rose almost twofold over the next 15 months. In the 2 years before treatment, she had experienced between 7 to 9 severe pain crises every year. In the year and a half after treatment, she has had none. Thus far, there have been no reports of leukemia in this study. It's also too early to tell if there are adverse effects that will emerge over time, but there is a chance that this woman has been cured of sickle cell anemia. At Stanford, another group, led by Matt Porteous, is using gene editing to rewrite and correct the culprit sickling mutation in hemoglobin beta. Fetal hemoglobin is not activated, but rather the culprit mutation is gene edited. Porteous' strategy is also in trials, and early results have been promising. I don't know if William K. will choose to be treated with any one of these novel therapies. I am no longer his doctor. But having known him intimately for a decade, and knowing his spirit of adventure, the terrifying frequency of his pain crisis, and the haunting fear of opioid addiction, I would suspect that he may well be lining up for one of these trials. When he does get transplanted, he too will cross a border. He will become a new human, built out of his own re-engineered cells. He will be a new sum of new parts.
The Song of the Cell, an exploration of medicine and the new human, was written by Siddhartha Mukherjee and read by Dennis Boutsakaris. It was recorded by Skylar Kilborn at Dave & Dave Studios in Valley Village, California, and Chris Bittner at Applehead Studios in Woodstock, New York. Editing, mix, and post-production by Ponderosa Post. The associate producer was Joy Asuquo. The Song of the Cell, an exploration of medicine and the new human, was produced and directed by Randy Dalnick. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Song of the Cell, an exploration of medicine and the new human, is available in print from Scribner. Also by Siddhartha Mukherjee for Simon & Schuster Audio. The Gene, An Intimate History, read by Dennis Boutsakaris. And The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer, read by Fred Sanders.